fourth case of the day, Green versus Nuveen. Mr. Johnson?
Good morning, Your Honors. Lawrence Johnson for the plaintiff's appellant. In preparing for this morning's argument, it occurred to me that I sometimes have difficulty in keeping sight of the forest while I'm laboring amongst the trees in this case. So I thought that a good place for me to begin would be with how the Investment Company Act of 1940 bears upon the issue in this case and what it teaches us with respect to the interpretation of the particular section of the Act at issue. Section 1 of the Act begins by reciting congressional findings with respect to a number of practices or conditions in the investment company industry which Congress finds are contrary to the national interest. One of those, and some courts have intimated that it is perhaps the most significant of all the conditions which Congress examined, is the condition or practice by which some investment companies were operated in the interests of their creator, the investment advisor or its affiliate, rather than in the interest of the actual investors. Section 1B of the Act goes on to provide very clear and explicit instructions as to how the provisions of the Act are to be interpreted. Section 1B says that the Act is to be interpreted so as to mitigate and, so far as feasible, eliminate the abuses or conditions enumerated at the beginning of Section 1. And of course, as we all know, Section 36B of the Act, which was enacted by Congress in 1970, places the investment advisor of investment companies under a fiduciary duty with respect to the receipt of compensation. Now, I submit to Your Honor that there is no doubt, and indeed the defendants conceded, that an advisor who actually manages an investment company's leverage in order to preserve and maximize its own advisory compensation is in fact managing that investment company in its own interests rather than the interests of the investors, and I suggest to the court that that is indeed a very paradigm of self-interested management which the Investment Company Act seeks to prevent and if possible to eliminate. Thus the question in this case, Your Honors, is whether it is consistent with the advisor's fiduciary duty under Section 36B of the Act, as that duty is defined by any standard that is consistent with the Act's objectives and its purpose to eliminate advisor self-dealing, for an advisor to have, gratuitously, a compensation arrangement that provides the motive and the opportunity for the advisor to deal with fund leverage in its own interests rather than in the interests of the investors. And of course, this case also presents the question of whether, if not, there has been shown as a matter of law on this record that it is either not feasible to eliminate that conflict or some other legal justification that has been shown as a matter of law. Now, I have in mind that the court below, in concluding and granting summary judgment to the defendant, concluded that a 36B violation is not made out for essentially two reasons. First of all, that the fiduciary duty doesn't extend to what the court characterized as potential conflicts of interest, and second, concomitantly, what one must prove in order to make out a violation of Section 36B is actual instances of mismanagement. I submit to the court that neither of those grounds can withstand examination. First of all, as to the scope of Section 36B, I hark back to the standard of interpretation which Section 1 provides. The statute is remedial It is preventative. Its purpose is aimed at eliminating advisory self-dealing. And I put before you two hypotheticals, two tax-exempt municipal bond funds, one of which has an advisor like Nuveen in this case, one-third of which of its compensation is dependent upon the maintenance of full leverage, and the record shows, Your Honors, that for these five funds at issue in this case alone, that amounted to something on the order of $11 million just for one period in 1993 when interest rates were rising and when the funds maintained full leverage. It amounts for all of the 50 or so such funds managed by Nuveen to tens of millions of dollars a year. The question is, of course, does the statute really address only eliminating actual mismanagement, or does it not say, in effect, the occasion for self-interested dealing is to be eliminated if possible? The statute, of course, doesn't say that advisors are only to be liable if they actually mismanage a fund. It says that they're under a fiduciary duty. And I suggest to the court that by any standard of fiduciary duty, it doesn't have to be state common law standards, any standard that's consistent with preventing self-dealing, having a gratuitous an arrangement or compensation arrangement which gives the motivation to handle leverage for your own benefit rather than the benefit of the investors, that is simply at war with the concept of fiduciary duty. The second leg of the court's opinion below, the second major leg, was that what we have to prove in order to make out a case is not the existence of this kind of conflict, no matter how strong and significant it is in financial terms, but rather some actual instance of mismanagement. And that doesn't withstand examination either. First of all, I suggest to Your Honors that if that's what this remedial statute was intended to do, it's a mirage. Because, of course, once we show that Nuveen actually managed leverage on these funds for the purpose of increasing or maintaining its own advisory compensation, we didn't need Congress to give us a remedy with respect to that. That, I suggest to you, was actionable as a matter of law before Section 36B was ever passed. It would have been, first, a breach of the advisor's duty of loyalty, and second, a breach of the provisions of each of the advisory contracts between the Nuveen and the funds at issue in this case. Because every one of those advisory agreements, and they're in the record, requires Nuveen to manage the affairs of each investment company for the benefit of the stockholders. And of course, there is implied into every one of those agreements a covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And to actually mismanage the fund for the purposes of maximizing your own compensation would have been a breach of the express and implied provisions of the advisory agreements. Congress didn't need to act to do that. Secondly, if that's what we have to prove, then the remedy is not only unnecessary, Your Honors, it is illusory, because as a practical matter, it's almost impossible to do. The management of leverage involves exercise, and exercise with respect to difficult matters of judgment. In this case, for example, in the one period of time that the record examines in detail, namely the 16-month period from late 1992 to early 1994, when interest rates were going up constantly, during that period, the Nuveen defendants have asserted that, they maintained leverage in order to maximize the stream of tax-exempt income which could be passed on to the investors. And they point out, and they're correct, that the primary investment objective of the fund was maximizing the stream of tax-exempt income. Of course, it's also undisputed that the secondary investment objective of the fund, also relevant to their performance of their duties, was preserving portfolio value. They say, well, we were maximizing tax-exempt income. It's noteworthy, however, that nobody ever asked them, and they never offered to the directors, and the directors never asked, well, if you conducted a cost-benefit analysis of this, how much tax-exempt income are you preserving, and at what cost? They never did. They never provided that, and the record is devoid of any indication that that kind of information was provided to the directors. The directors never apparently asked for it. Our experts in the case did conduct such an analysis, and what they found, and it appears on the record, in the record, I think it's pages 670 to 672, is that during that 16-month period, by keeping full leverage, these funds preserved some $98 million in tax-exempt income stream. But at what cost? The funds lost over $200 million in portfolio value. They paid $11 million in additional advisory compensation on the assets attributable to the leverage. They incurred some $40 to $50 million in additional costs, mainly the dividends on the preferred. Thus, the total cost of preserving that $98 million of tax-exempt income was something on the order of $266 million. Now, does that mean as a matter of law that they were corrupt? No, not necessarily. What it means is that the question at that time of whether to exercise, what judgment to exercise, what to do about leverage, whether to eliminate, whether to reduce it, whether to preserve it, unreduced as Nuveen did, that was a matter of judgment. And it's not difficult with hindsight, of course, to come up with a rationale either way for what you did was okay. And Nuveen says, well, what we did was okay, and here's why: it was to preserve the income stream. And it's just a coincidence that it happened to accord with our own financial self-interest, too. Now, of course, in other and related worlds of fiduciary duty, trustees and executors, when a trustee buys or sells his own property in a dealing with the trust, he isn't heard to say, gee, it was a good deal for the trust, that it's just a coincidence that it was my property that I was buying or selling. You don't get to do that, and I suggest that the purposes of the Investment Company Act, Your Honor, are also prophylactic and preventative, and it just flies in the face of those purposes to say to the investors, well, you only have a remedy. You don't have a remedy to prevent this kind of conflict. You only have a remedy if you can prove that as a result of the conflict, the advisor, actually motivated by corrupt and venial motives, mismanaged the fund on some particular occasion. The idea, Your Honors, is to avoid the occasion, to prevent the occasion. Now, the other principal ground relied upon by the district court and argued by my brothers is this question of the effect of the director's control over leverage and their having approved the advisory agreement and whatever Nuveen did or didn't do with respect to leverage. And I need to address that too. Now, it is perfectly correct that as a matter of corporate governance, the directors had the ultimate authority with respect to making changes in leverage. There's no doubt about that. But I suggest, and that wasn't disputed, and we didn't dispute it, but what we did point out in our response to the defendant's statement of undisputed facts was that that isn't the whole story, because it's equally true on this record, and also undisputed by the defendants, that the directors, while they had the authority, they relied primarily, if not entirely, upon the investigations and recommendations of Nuveen Advisory with respect to the management of leverage, as indeed with respect to every other aspect of the management of the funds. And the record is replete with evidence, not just from Ms. Rosenheim, but from one director after another, showing that the directors were not proactive with respect to questions of leverage, despite their supposed awareness of the fact that Nuveen had a substantial interest in leverage decisions because of its compensation arrangement. I suggest, Your Honor, that who had the ultimate control is a matter of entire irrelevancy. Indeed, Section 36B says that the advisor is under a fiduciary duty with respect to the receipt of compensation, but we all know that the the advisor doesn't have ultimate control with respect to the amount of its compensation either. That's the subject of an agreement between the fund and the advisor, and under the Investment Company Act, that agreement has to be approved by the board of directors. They have ultimate authority over that too, and the cases are perfectly clear that the fact that they have ultimate authority over the amount of compensation doesn't foreclose an excessive compensation case either. The question I submit to your honors is not who had the ultimate control, but whether it is consistent with the advisor's fiduciary duty for it to have this conflicting interest with respect to one of the matters which it's being paid to give the fund disinterested advice on, and which the fund's directors are relying upon it to give them disinterested advice on. Does it make sense to permit them to have this conflict in that? Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, you conclude your remark.
Thank you. I didn't see the white light either. I'm sorry to say, have I eliminated my right to rebuttal? I'm very sorry. Thank you.
Mr. McCall?
Good morning, Your Honor. Kevin McCall, and I represent the defendant appellee, Nuveen Advisory. The district, may it please the court. The district court here correctly granted summary judgment for Nuveen Advisory after full discovery in this case. In doing so, the court relied on a number of grounds, including the grounds that the district court in New Jersey relied upon in granting summary judgment in an essentially identical case. Now, there was no mention of that case in Mr. Johnson's remarks. We have submitted to the court a 26F letter referencing the case of Green versus Fund Asset Management, which was an essentially companion case. Both cases were filed in the district court in Massachusetts at the same time. The Third Circuit recently affirmed the grant of summary judgment in the Fund Asset Management case. They are the same case. There are no differences between the cases. The expert reports, the evidence, the theory of the case, everything is the same between those two cases. So the district court here granted summary judgment relying on the rationale of the Fund Asset Management case. It also referred to two additional grounds, that the directors here controlled the leverage, and therefore there was in fact no conflict of interest. Now the plaintiffs below didn't respond to the argument that there was no conflict here because the directors controlled the leverage. And the district court noted that in its opinion granting summary judgment. So the plaintiffs have waived any basis for complaining about the court's reliance upon the director's control of leverage here, since they didn't even object in their brief below. In addition, the court noted that the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, the companion statute for the Investment Company Act, and a statute which should be interpreted in conformity with the Investment Company Act, that act specifically permits the fee structure at issue here. Again, plaintiffs did not respond to the argument concerning the Investment Advisors Act below. And therefore, again, they have waived any objection to affirmance of the court's opinion on the grounds of the statutory provisions of the Investment Advisors Act. Now, let me turn to the Third Circuit's opinion in the Fund Asset Management case. The Third Circuit there found that the existence of a potential conflict is not enough. And indeed, that's what this case is all about. Plaintiffs really are arguing that there's a per se conflict here, that the fact that there's a potential for a fee structure to be misused constitutes the violation of 36B. The Third Circuit specifically rejected that proposition and noted that every fee arrangement has the potential for a conflict. What would need to be proved is an actual breach of fiduciary duty, not a per se or a potential conflict. The court also noted that Section 36B is intended to provide a very narrow remedy. It's intended to establish a very narrow duty. It is not intended to address all breaches of fiduciary duty. The court in the Third Circuit also noted that the district court properly took into account the director's approval of the fees, the same as Judge Guzman did in this case. Finally, they noted that because plaintiffs did not point to any instance during the statute of limitations period that they hadn't proved any breach. And again, it was the same period that we're talking about. In the Third Circuit case, plaintiffs complained about conduct which occurred in the period of late 1993 through the first quarter of 1995. And their case there was filed at the same time. And the Third Circuit noted that's outside the period for which you can recover damages, so you have no claim. It's the same problem here. Finally, the court noted there that the plaintiffs had conceded in that case that they were not entitled to any damages for the 1993 to 1995 time period. And I would note for the court here that in the first decision below, Judge Bucklow noted in her decision dismissing all the claims other than the 36B claim that plaintiffs had made the same concession. In other words, plaintiffs have previously conceded in this case, and it's referenced specifically in Judge Bucklow's opinion, that they're not entitled to recover any damages, that they have no real claim for the conduct which occurred in the 1995 in the 1993 through first quarter of 1995 time period. Now, plaintiffs here seek to attack the predominant fee structure in the entire mutual fund industry. This is the fee structure that's used by every comparable fund, 202 funds that are identical. For funds which lever with preferred shares, this is the fee structure used by 99.6%. There's only one that doesn't use this fee structure. And if you look at all of the bond funds in existence, all of them, whether they lever with debt or whether they lever with preferred shares, this is the fee structure used by 82% of them. Those are undisputed facts that are in the record. 82% of all leveraged funds use this fee structure. And plaintiffs want this court to find that it's a per se violation of the Investment Company Act to use this fee structure. Now, plaintiffs have suggested that Congress didn't know of the use of this fee structure by leveraged funds. And that's totally beside the point. First of all, they offer no evidence to support the assertion that funds leveraging with preferred shares haven't used the structure at all times. They've made some reference to tax benefits that became available in 1976, but that issue is pertinent only to municipal funds. There have long been other leveraged funds. Moreover, the subsequent amendments of the Investment Company Act, the Investment Advisors Act, in 1980, 87, and 96, long after it was clear that the fee structures in place for these funds and for many other leveraged municipal funds were in place, those amendments did nothing to further restrict the use of this fee structure. This fee structure was specifically approved by Congress in the Investment Advisors Act, as Judge Guzman found, and his plaintiffs did not even respond to. This is the fee structure that the SEC assumes all funds will use. The SEC forms basically say, state your fee structure as a basis of net asset value. Net asset value is the fee structure that virtually every fund uses. So prohibiting this fee structure not only finds a violation by all municipal leveraged funds, but really by virtually all other funds that are out there, because NAV is used by 93% of all funds in existence, and that's thousands. I forget whether the number is 5,000 or 10,000. It grows every day. But this is the fee structure in existence for all funds, and every advisor can be found to have a motive to maximize assets. And if that's enough to find a per se violation of 36B, There is no fee structure that's going to pass muster. Further, as I mentioned before, one of the grounds that the court relied on was the director's control of leverage. And the court found that there was no conflict here because, in fact, the directors controlled leverage. Now, plaintiffs didn't oppose that, so they certainly can't now come and object to that. More importantly, plaintiffs' own experts agreed that director control of the leverage would eliminate any theoretical or actual conflict. And that can be found at the record 144 in the Statement of Additional Fact, Exhibit 26, and the testimony of Mr. Monrad, who acknowledged the existence, one of their experts, he acknowledged the existence of a similar conflict with respect to a fee structure of a fund of which he was a director. This is the fee structure that plaintiffs prefer, but he was given an example where he acknowledged that there was a conflict with that fee structure. And he stated, well, there would be no real conflict in that situation of his fund. And the reason was because the directors controlled leverage and the directors were independent. There's simply no evidence that the directors here did not have the information necessary to exercise control over the leverage. In addition, it's undisputed here that Nuveen Advisory actually recommended deleveraging at one point in time, at a point in time when it would have been consistent with the objectives of the funds to deleverage. At that one point in time, they recommended deleveraging. The board approved that recommendation, but the threshold that was established for that deleveraging was never reached, and so the funds were never delevered. A plaintiff's entire case here has simply ignored the objectives of the funds. It's undisputed that the primary objective of these funds was to produce tax-free income. It's undisputed that leverage always produced additional income for these funds, and that the primary objective was always served. Plaintiffs have attempted to misdescribe the secondary objective as simply enhancing portfolio value. But that's not what the secondary objective is. The secondary objective was to enhance portfolio value by picking undervalued bonds. That's all. Nothing else. Not by predicting interest rates. Plaintiffs suggest, in effect, that the court should have abandoned the primary objective of these funds, pursued some objective that was not a stated objective of these funds, made some speculative call with respect to interest rates when there's no evidence in the record at all that they had any idea what interest rates would do in 1994, the worst bond market in the history of the bond market. So there simply is no basis for suggesting in any respect that it would have been prudent for these funds to delever. Because it would not have been consistent with their objectives. And under the Investment Company Act, these funds are obligated to be managed in accordance with their objectives. So in other words, if these funds had pursued the strategy suggested by plaintiffs, it would have violated their objectives. And they could have been sued for that. In addition, it's clear that there's no evidence of any actual damages or actual conflict here. That was the basis of the Third Circuit's opinion, and it's equally applicable here. Plaintiffs concede that they can't identify any incorrect decisions. That's at their brief at 25. And that's why they cling to the assertion that this is a per se violation. More importantly, the evidence that relates to 1994 doesn't even support their claim. Because a fundamental premise here is the suggestion that somehow these funds could have done better by deleveraging, that these losses that impacted the whole bond market could have been avoided by deleveraging. But the undisputed evidence in the record is that the funds that did delever suffered worse losses. They had worse total returns in 1994. So deleveraging did nothing for funds which delevered. They had worse total returns in 1994, and they had nowhere near the good performance that these funds had in 1995 when the bond market rebounded. Volatility of net asset value, fluctuations in the principal value of bonds, is part and parcel of an investment in a bond fund. Leveraging increases that volatility, but there's absolutely no evidence in the record that there's any period of time for which these plaintiffs could recover, where there were damages that actually could have been avoided by deleveraging. Now, the final point that I want to touch upon is the scope of Section 36B. Section 36B is intended to be a narrow remedy, as the Third Circuit found. The Fourth Circuit, in the Migdal case, has similarly indicated that Section 36B is intended to be a very narrow remedy. It's intended to address excessive fees. Now, plaintiffs have conceded this is not an excessive fee case. And under the dictates of the Migdal case, that concession in itself ends it. Section 36B is not a catch-all provision intended to provide a means of remedying any alleged breach of fiduciary duty. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Johnson, your time has expired, but you may have a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Try not to trench on the minute. First of all, with respect to the Investment Advisors Act, the relevance of what the Investment Advisors Act does with respect to this is nil. And the reason it's nil is that the Investment Advisors Act doesn't place the advisor under a fiduciary duty with respect to the receipt of compensation. The Investment Company Act does. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, the Investment Advisors Act deals with you and I hire an investment advisor. Those advisors have no power with respect to leverage at all. That simply doesn't arise. It's not an issue that arises under the Investment Advisors Act. Now, with respect to the use of NAV, we are not attacking the use of net asset value. We are attacking the use of any measure which includes the leveraged assets. Debt-leveraged funds don't have that problem with net asset value. Equity-leveraged funds do, and that's where the rub is. As far as the scope of 36B goes, and that's the last thought, and I'll finish it in a single sentence, it is not confined to excessive compensation, and the authority for that is the Galfand case in New York, which we cite in our brief. It's not an excessive compensation case, regardless of how it has been characterized by other courts. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to